Some people say that going to college and going on in life and doing something different from what one studied in college means that you wasted your college years. Well, I studied criminology, sociology, deviant psychology, abnormal psychology, and went into show business.
Gotta figure out some way to get that money, honestly.
Well, that could be a problem.
It's like the penguin says, we gotta make that move towards redemption. We gotta go to church.
You gotta make that move toward redemption, you gotta go to church.
Bullshit. Come on. The club where we came up with the Blues Brothers was a speakeasy that I had in Toronto called the 505 Club, and John was up recruiting the National Lampoon Radio Hour, trying to steal talent from Second City and bring them down to New York. He managed to grab Gilda Radner. I didn't want to go because I was on a children's TV show. I had Second City. I was making more money than the Prime Minister of Canada. Plus, I had my speakeasy. I had walls of cash, cash in the walls, from this after-hours illegal booze can called the 505 Club. And the night John came up to recruit for radio show, we came back to the booze can. We had a party there, and we started to play old blues records. And I had a Down Child Blues Band. Put them on. He said, who's this? I said, well, this is Down Child Blues Band, a local blues band. He said, you're from Chicago. I said, John, you should know about the blues. He said, well, I'm into Grand Funk and Allman Brothers. I said, well, that's all blues. And I reacquainted him with blues, and he reacquainted me with sort of heavy metal. And Howard Shore was in the place that night. He eventually became musical director of Saturday Night Live. And we were saying, we should put a band together. And he said, yeah, you could call yourself the Blues Brothers. Subsequently, that's what we did.
Belushi was very into heavy metal. He had his head-banging room, and they had a townhouse on 60 Morton Street in the Village in New York. And he had this, like, padded room. And he'd go in there, and only Michael Jackson. He's the only other person I know who plays music that loud. They'd crank up this, you know, heavy metal stuff, and your fillings would hurt. It was like, you know.
When I was working at Saturday Night Live as an arranger in 1978, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi came back from a weekend in San Francisco, and they had stayed up all night with a fellow named Curtis Salgado listening to blues records. Curtis Salgado was the harmonica player with the Robert Crepe Blues Band. On the way back on the airplane, John and Danny came up with the idea of these two characters that later became called the Blues Brothers.
Back then it was just to sort of explore the music, have a little fun with it, make the audience laugh in the warm-ups, pull off our appearances in Saturday Night Live, and kind of come off to sell these characters. But as it evolved, the mission was to reacquaint people or acquaint people for the first time with this tremendous form of American music.
We rehearsed the Saturday Night Live band, and we were hoping to get this routine on the show.
The fact that John and Danny were so popular, they were heroes already with the public.
We wore the suits for a couple of occasions, then we took the act to the show as a warm-up act.
The timing was right. The public was behind these kids. from the get-go.
Once we got the show, we started to play around on weekends. We played at the Lone Star Cafe. Our backup bands at one time were like, you know, Willie Nelson's band and Room Full of Blues, Duke Robillard's band. And
we got letters and cards and phone calls, which led to another appearance of the Blues Brothers.
Then we put it on the show with Carrie Fisher's guest host appearance and with Steve Martin subsequently, and then Steve Martin asked us to open for him at the Universal Amphitheater.
When we looked into the crowd at the beginning of the show, Jack Nicholson, I mean, it was like the who's who of Hollywood, all with their dark glasses on.
Nicholson was right in the first seat, and he had his shades on, you know, and I looked over and he caught my eye and lifted up his shades. Lowered his shades, you know. Cool.
No one was prepared for the phenomenal success that the Jake and Elwood suddenly had because they opened for Steve Martin at the Universal Amphitheater, and then an album was made of that. And that album was so, I think to this day, it's the highest selling blues album, which is pretty bizarre.
We came along at a time when there was a real sort of lull and a dip in American music tastes, and you know, the sort of one fad was going out and people weren't really sure what the next fad was going to be.
It was black music. It was blues and rhythm and blues. And at that time, black music was, you know, Nile Rodgers and Chic singing La Freak. It was all disco.
It was sort of the disco new wave cusp, and in there we kind of were able to slot in and do the song that a lot of people knew, but with a different kind of a twist to it, and with the image associated with who the Blues Brothers were. The album went on to sell 3.5 million copies, and we had a viable sort of entertainment act after that.
We put the band back together, we do a few gigs, we get some bread, bang, $5,000.
Yeah, well, getting the band back together might not be that easy, Jake.
Well, the band itself had basically been assembled already by Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, and really by Paul Schaefer.
John Belushi and I handpicked this band 20 years ago.
We started to play with the Saturday Night Live band, and Bones Malone was there, and Paul Schaefer, and Bones said, hey, you know, have you ever heard of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn? And, well, I hadn't really heard of them, but I knew of the Stax Volt movement in the 60s in Memphis.
A buddy of mine used to call me, and usually if I was in the middle of mixing or overdubbing or something like that, they'd say Steve is busy and he can't come to the phone right now, and I'll leave a message. Well, we had this little thing that he would call and he would pretend that he was somebody, and he'd say, this is, you know, President Nixon, or this is Stevie Wonder, or this is da-da-da-da-da. And I get this call, and they said, John Belushi's on the phone. And I go, oh, yeah, my buddy. Hey, Alan, what's going on? He said, who? And I said, Alan, this isn't you. And he said, no, this is John Belushi.
One night I got a call long ago from John Belushi. It was about 3 a.m, and I thought it was a friend of mine putting me on. He said, this is John Belushi. He says, we're going to put this band together. I like your bass playing. Would you come to New York and rehearse? And I hung up. 5 minutes later, he calls back. He said, this is not a joke. It's John Belushi.
Anyway, I told him, I said, well, man, I'll have to get back to you. I just, you know. So in talking to Robin Ford a little bit later, he said, well, who was that? You know, and I said, well, believe it or not, I said, it was John Belushi. And he said, oh, what's going on with that? And I said, well, he wants me to come to New York and start rehearsing for some shows. And he says, well, you going to do it? And I said, well, I don't know if I can. He said, well, I'll do it. So when my artist said he'd do it, I said, well, we'll try to work something out.
Having them come along, Duck and Steve, because they were real R&B guitar players and real men of soul, it legitimized what we were up to and gave us sort of a whole a purpose and a meaning there, just beyond doing a kind of a comedy act, and we started to revive some of these songs.
It was very important to John Belushi to have a hot lead guitar player. And I just kept saying to him, John, let's get somebody good. He wanted to jump and get that spot in the band filled.
I was swapping licks with Johnny Winter, and this guy named Doc Pomus, I think it was, is had told them about me. So they come up and they introduce themselves. My name is John and this is Dan. We thinking about making an album. Would you like to help us make it? And I said, I would be glad to help you make it.
We saw him playing at a club in Columbus Avenue. He played with James Cotton. I had seen him before. I'd known of his work for many years, and we approached him.
When I was talking to him, and we were supposed to be negotiating, you know, like, so he goes, well, Matt, yes, that's good. You're going to help us. So I think I think the figure is going to be like 650. I goes, oh, no, man. I think that should be more. And he goes, oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant 6,500. And I almost fell off the chair. $6,500. Jesus, I couldn't believe that. You know, I didn't think it was going to be near that much, you know.
So the band was pretty much intact, although there was this very political, it's a long involved story, and there's like Rashomon, lots of sides. But Paul was prevented from being in the first movie by unnamed people. But he couldn't be in the first movie.
There was some problems with Paul Schaefer's availability owing to a contractual dispute with Saturday Night Live and all sorts of difficulties. So he couldn't get out of his contract. And so John Landis had seen this film where I played the piano, and John Belushi knew I played piano, so voila, I was on the plane.
And then Willie Hall, Duck and Steve, recommended Willie, and they had knew him from Memphis. They had played a lot with him in Memphis with Isaac Hayes and other stuff.
Some of the people that we hired were in the original Saturday Night Live band, most notably the three horn players.
Our friend Lou Delgado from the Saturday Night Live show played the fourth horn part, but there was no fourth horn player in the movie, so that's one of the anomalies of the movie. You're always hearing four horns playing, but there's only three of us on stage.
The Blues Brothers Band is an amazing group of musicians, and basically it's a Memphis rhythm section with a New York horn section, and the idea of taking that kind of fatback rhythm and putting slick New York horns on top of it, combined with the special vocals and harp playing of Dan Aykroyd, was really amazing. They were a great band and great to listen to. If you listen to the records, you can hear them doing great stuff.
The guys in the band are some of the most accomplished musicians you'll ever come across in your life.
We recognized their talent, their abilities. They recognized that although we were not the greatest vocalists slash harp players, we weren't the greatest front men. We provided an energy, and we provided a package for the band and sort of an enclosure to reintroduce the world to a lot of this music.
Danny's a maven. I mean, he's a real, not only a true fan, but an expert in blues and rhythm and blues, and has a real passion for it.
I used to get more people, interviewers and you know, fans as well, going, well, what's the thing on John Belushi and Hacker? They really can't sing, can they? They really can't. I said, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think I'm a fairly well-qualified musician. I've been a producer for so many years, and I said, I think he sings a lot better than some artists that are out there.
If you had heard John Belushi at rehearsals like we did, I mean, I have some cassettes at home of the original rehearsals, like little pieces of it. He was good, man. This guy had great time. I think he was a drummer.
He had such a love for it, and he played drums in a band. I mean, he kept decent time. He had his rhythm down. You know, he never missed a step or a cue.
We tried to, you know, pick blues songs that weren't Delta blues. We've never been a Delta blues band, and Delta blues is the primitive rural blues. We were always a Chicago electrified urban blues band fused with the Memphis Stax Volt movement. And so I think what we tried to do is represent that in the movie is the best way we could.
The creation of the mythology of these characters has been very strong, very successful. I mean, to the point where it's kind of scary, where I meet people who tell me, you know, Jake and Elwood Blues are these, you know, legendary blues artists, and I'm like, uh-oh.
We put together what I like to call the, you know, the third greatest rhythm and blues review in the world, the first being James Brown, the second being Tina Turner's, and the third being us.
First you trade the Cadillac for a microphone, then you lie to me about the band. Now you're going to put me right back in the joint.
They're not going to catch us. We're on a mission from God.
Well, me and the Lord, we got an understanding.
We're on a mission from God.
Would it make you feel any better if you knew that what we're asking Matt here to do is a holy thing?
You see, we're on a mission from God.
We need this gig.
We're on a mission from God.
When Judy Belushi and John and I come up with the sort of the backstory and the concept of the Blues Brothers to sort of filling in our own conceptions of who they were and where they came from after the first album came out. I remembered all that stuff from Krim and sat down and kind of used it in creating the profile of two guys who start out basically in an orphanage and homeless and end up in a life of crime because they never really had a family. And that's a lot of criminals, most of your criminals, have that as an origin.
Danny had said, thinking of all these adventures for the Blues Brothers, they had a big life, and it sounded great, and so we made the deal at Universal Studios, and Danny went away to write.
I really didn't know how to write movies. I didn't know anything. I don't think I'd ever even seen a screenplay. I was told that most screenplays were, 120 to 150 pages long, but when I sat down to write The Blues Brothers, there were so many descriptive passages in there, just paragraphs and paragraphs of shots, of concept, of ideas, of descriptions, and eventually it just kind of ballooned up.
The thing about Dan Aykroyd, he's a marvelous writer, and what he has that's really great are ideas. His conceptions are so strong.
I had the idea that, well, what I'll do here is, there's no way I could get it all into one movie or one script, I figured, well, I might as well get all of the knowledge that I have about the Blues Brothers, all of the conceptions, John's input, my input, Judy's input, and put it all in one volume, even though it would be prohibitively long. And I figured, devise the method of writing actually two scripts at one time.
Dan Aykroyd had written actually a 324-page script that actually had a story for recruiting each member of the band individually. Now that script, which by the way was delivered to me in the covers of the Valley Yellow Pages, because it was as big as a phone book, so I think Dan Aykroyd tried to take a little of the sting out with a little humor, actually making it look like a phone book.
Dan Aykroyd had really written an incredible tome about these two guys, and John then took it and edited it and tried to make it into a screenplay form, which was actually something that he could shoot.
I thought, there's no way to shoot this. It was pretty incoherent, but it had great ideas and epic characters and a real respect for the music, and it was big.
When I handed it in, I didn't know what Landis was going to do with it or how he's going to manage it down, but he was an accomplished filmmaker. He had written scripts before, and he was able to take it and distill it down to an actual form of screenplay at 120 pages.
We started shooting before we had a finished screenplay, really.
Won't you welcome from Calumet City, Illinois, the show band of Joliet Jake and Elwood Blues, the Blues Brothers.
All blues music has great humor in it, and just the rhythms and the feeling of joy that comes from singing it and playing it. I think we viewed all of it as being able to be relatively easily transmitted out there to the audience.
The songs were chosen by Danny and me and John, and it's just what we liked or what was interesting or what was appropriate to the scene.
I remember going down to his apartment down in the village where he and Judy lived. And this is during the period where he was selecting music. And he had this incredible shelf of 45s. And he put something on for about four measures. I said, nah, snap it. Put another one on, listen to it. Now he'd throw it on the floor and stomp on it. It was like Blutarsky in Animal House. I said, what are you wasting there? Give them away to somebody. He said, I hate this crap. And personally, I wasn't a big fan of this music all along. I mean, when it's good, any music is great, when it's really good. But I learned to appreciate it by being exposed to it through these guys. John really knew this stuff, and so did Danny.
If the music didn't work, throw it out. They didn't care. You know, we'd rehearse it three times, boom, out, you know. If it wasn't fun, we didn't do it.
It's always frustrated me that many people don't consider the movie a musical, which makes me nuts, you know, because it has more music than most musicals.
He said, because to him it's a musical, he says it's almost nonstop music. There's always music in the background, there's all these musical numbers. And he really felt that he was directing a musical. That's the way he looked at it.
I have a great love for the classic Hollywood musical. Musical comedy is an American theatrical form that was, you know, it's ours.
I knew the action part of it, but to me, loving old Hollywood and old Hollywood musicals, that's what I kept visualizing.
It's almost like a camouflaged musical. Musical usually means that main characters break into song to express emotion, and that doesn't happen in this.
It was a new kind of musical. It was absolutely, it was catching rhythms of life in the city and the times.
The musical numbers in the movie were kind of the crown jewels of the piece. The shoe leather that got you from one musical number to another was something that we always tried to keep to a minimum so that we could get into the great musical numbers that were in, that were set, the set pieces, if you will, in the movie.
There was an attempt to do every kind of performance. By that I mean like operetta, traditional musical comedy, which is an American form, where people are talking and then they burst into song, but the song furthers the plot. I wanted to do that, I did. Then there's performance numbers when you're on a stage performing, so I did that too. I did every kind of number that had been done in a film up to that time, so that was the intention.
He's not denying that they're car chases. Of course they're car chases. But there was a rhythm to them. They were musical numbers. They were production numbers. And if you just listen to the scoring and look at what you're seeing on the screen, those cars were dancing, baby. Those cars were dancing.
You know, the hard thing in a musical is getting a number that feels organic, that doesn't feel like a sudden departure in the picture. And I think we were very successful with most of the numbers in the Blues Brothers.
Musicals are inherently expensive because of the recording and the music. It's much more expensive now because of what's happened to the... To buy a song now is much more costly. I mean, in Animal House, I paid $2,000 for a Sam Cooke tune. Now I pay $60,000, $70,000 for the same piece of music.
I only remember one problem, and that was with a song called Sweet Home Chicago. Come on. I was waiting to hear from the studio who owned that song so we could negotiate the publishing rights and so forth, and I wasn't hearing anything. And then I got a memo from a guy here at Universal that said they weren't sure. And so I did a little research of my own, and it turned out that, well, MCA owned the rights to that music. And so I let the guy know, and after an embarrassed phone call, we had the rights to that song. But pretty much it all was fairly easy to get.
I hired this man, Carlton Johnson, who used to choreograph the Carol Burnett Show for years, very talented choreographer. He's passed away. Carlton was a very traditional kind of corny, you know.
He was great because he had to work with a variety of acts, the different guest talent that we had in the movie, and work with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd.
John and Danny aren't real dancers, therefore I won't use real dancers. So Carlton Johnson, our choreographer, was told, I want amateurs only. So I shot several numbers in Chicago, and by the time I put them together, I thought, ooh, that was a mistake. So when we did the church scene, we brought in professional dancers. Shake a tail feather, all amateurs in Chicago.
The Ray Charles number was big in that we were out on the streets of Chicago. We even had people dancing up on the elevated, up on the train. So that was tough.
All right.
When we shot the outside of Ray's Music Exchange with the hundreds of people in the streets dancing, it was freezing cold. I mean, freezing. And yet, the sequence takes place in the summer. So we had all these poor dancers out there wearing short sleeve shirts and things dancing away, and it was like 25 degrees.
Essentially, all of the moves in the movie are Carlton's, and some of the moves that we used subsequently in the act when we went on tour were Carlton's. And as I do, Everybody Needs Somebody Loves Today and Soul Man, we still do some of the moves that Carlton taught us, today.
Then it came about, you know, we wanted Aretha Franklin, we wanted John Lee Hooker, we knew, we wanted Ray Charles, we wanted James Brown. And fortunately for us, but unfortunately at the time, except for Ray Charles, most of these people weren't working. So it was easy to get them. You called up, they said, hey, you want a job? They went, please. So that was not the hard part.
It was great. We were getting to work with our heroes. And it was fantastic to be going to the likes of Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and James Brown to ask them to participate. And no one had really done anything like this before. So it was really very exciting for all of us.
There are certain singers, B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, who have trouble with lip sync and to playback. And the reason for that is interesting. It's because they never sing a song the same way twice. So it's quite great if you're seeing them live, but if you're trying to shoot them to playback, it's a huge pain in the ass because it's like, what is your mouth doing?
The only problem that you have editing musical numbers is do performers do it the same way, take after take, and Can they lip sync their dialogue, their song, especially if they're the ones that have made the song famous? I'm not going to mention any names here.
You better think.
They were not easy numbers to cut. Lots of takes, lots of different camera angles to choose from. Performance variations. It was. Those are hard days to shoot those scenes, and I think they looked. I think they looked pretty good.
One of the reasons it's so choppy was because Aretha couldn't lip sync correctly, and the other was my fault. Is I was doing jokes that were not amusing to anyone but me. I have a shot where you see Lulu Marini in the background, and he's framed so that you're cutting him here, which I found terribly funny, but everyone else went, that's weird, you know, so it's like...
I remember getting criticized in a review by Janet Maslin that in one of the shots, or a couple of the shots that I had picked in the diner, Blue Lou, the saxophone player, is you only see his legs because he's jumped up on top of the counter, and they complained about... she complained about how badly this was done and we shouldn't have used this shot and all. But, you know, it just seemed to work when we were doing it. But I guess everybody has his opinion.
So I go to see the Aretha scene. And half the scene, I'm dancing and I'm cut off from like here. You don't see the top of my head, you know. And so when I came back, Landis says, how'd you like the scene? I said, it sucked. He says, what are you talking about? You know, I said, it sucked. I said, I busted my ass to learn this dance sequence and to play at the same time. And half the time, you can't see my head. And so Stephen Katz says, well, Lou, you signed up for a lot of money and a little head, and that's what you got.
And now, people, when I woke up this morning, I heard a disturbing sound.
The James Brown scene that takes place in the church, you know, we found that... James couldn't sing the same way twice. And so what we did is we took the track, the music itself, and that was done to playback, and people sang to playback except for James Brown, and we recorded his lead vocal live.
When you shoot someone live, lip sync's not a problem because they're live. In the first movie, John Lee Hooker is live, James Brown was live, Ray Charles was playback, Aretha was playback, and all the Blues Brothers stuff was playback. But it really makes no difference because you the artists are the ones who perform it regardless. It's for technical reasons whether it's live or not.
Dan Aykroyd is a motorhead. The character of D-Day in Animal House was actually based on Danny Aykroyd by Harold Ramis and Chris Miller and Doug Kenny, and I didn't know Danny at that time. And I learned later that, hey, this is this guy. You know, he likes bikes, likes motorcycles. He likes Danny's idea of a good time is to get in his car in Los Angeles and drive to New York straight. You know, he enjoys that.
Well, I've always liked cars, but I was really writing, The whole concept of the Bluesmobile and why it was an old police car was basically Elwood's concept. It was, you know, sort of living inside the character.
Elwood is a genius driver. He does extraordinary things with this car.
It's got a lot of pickup. It's got a cop motor, a 440 cubic inch plant. It's got cop tires, cop suspension, cop shocks. It's a model made before catalytic converters, so it'll run good on regular gas. What do you say? Is it the new Bluesmobile or what? Fix a cigarette lighter.
At that time, the hottest police car in America was the Dodge Monaco with the 440 cubic inch engine. And that, you know, became the Bluesmobile because, you know, Elwood knew that he had to stay at least, if not one jump ahead of the law, at least, you know, on the same kind of technological footing with them. So that's really Elwood's call.
Aykroyd actually decorated the thing. That's why you saw those cigarette packs in the, I think they were Chesterfield King, right? Cigarette packs had to be matches, gum wrappers, you know.
There were lots of different Bluesmobiles. They were Bluesmobiles that were specifically for high-performance driving, stunt driving.
Basically, the idea of the magic car came from me. I mean, I finally just said, Danny tends to want to explain this stuff. In fact, in the new movie, he had this whole thing where, at one point in the new film, the car goes underwater, and Danny wanted to show, you know, propellers coming out. And I said, that's James Bond. That's, you know, we don't have Q. It's a magic car, Danny. It does it because I said so, you know. I mean, what's one of the things about film? You show people, there it is, you know. You want a giant bug? There's your giant bug. You don't have to explain your giant bug. There it is, you know.
A couple of scenes that were omitted from the first movie. One was, one of my favorite was, sort of explained how the Bluesmobile got imbued with special powers to do backflips and that. And it was that we parked it in a secret hiding place under the L train in Chicago in a transformer room, to which I had a key. And the room opened up with these big steel plate doors, and inside were these humming transformers, and the Bluesmobile sort of parked in there every night and sort of absorbed the power of the electrical transformers under the L train.
Well, we actually shot a scene. We shot a scene where you saw it was stored under this transformer, the big electrical hum. It was part of the Peter Gunn thing, and I cut it out. You know, when the movie was too long, I had to cut stuff, and quite honestly, I don't think any, I think I said to Danny, are you going to go with each print and explain to people, see how we're parked near this transformer? That's why the car can do this stuff. Because that makes no sense, you know, it's like, you know. But Danny said it made sense.
The Bluesmobile that was supposed to tumble end over end, and originally the notion was to launch the miniature, and the miniature itself was about 4.5 feet long. And there are all these novel ways that the effects guys were proposing to do that, and we started going out to see some of these tests, which really fizzled one after the other. And what we finally decided was to get a bunch of guys and just throw it in the air, and I think that's the way we did it.
And then cut to the Nazi station wagon being dropped over the Lower Wacker area, a vacant lot. And we had a target zone of 50 by 50 feet. And
I remember there was a specific thing where we wanted to drop the Pinto belonging to the Illinois Nazis past the sky. You wanted to see it fall past the skyline. And so how we were going to do that was actually drop the Pinto from a helicopter. We had to have the Ford Pinto certified by the FAA. They actually wanted to know about its unairworthiness because they were afraid it might have, you know, be like an airfoil and somehow in the middle of the drop go sailing off over Lakeshore Drive. So we had to do drop tests where we dropped the Pinto from the helicopter, had to hit a specific place. We were using the area where they store salt that gets spread during the snowstorms of the winter, that has nothing on it during the summer and is away from a populated area, although it is within the city. And so we proved to the FAA in the city that we could hit a mark, and we dropped this Pinto, and it fell right on the X where we wanted it and flattened it. It was about this high when we got done with it. But that's how we were able to do that shot.
I've always loved you.
We were fortunate enough to find the Dixie Mall in Harvey, Illinois. This was an abandoned mall. It was a one in a million. I mean, you just don't go around finding these things abandoned. And in fact, we felt like archaeologists from the 31st century or something, going into this place with our flashlights. All the power was off, dust flying everywhere, and the place had been closed for over a year.
I'm proud to say we were the first movie to trash a mall, because I thought, And so that sequence came out of a location scout.
It was just perfect for what we wanted. And we ended up shooting there for, like, I think a week.
At the beginning, before they go in the mall, there's this giant parking lot that they drive around. And it's like, well, how are we going to fill this parking lot? So I remember we made a deal to get brand new cars. Every car in that parking lot is a brand new car. that's just there to fill up the parking lot, because otherwise we couldn't fill the parking lot. And I remember, like, you know, the production manager saying, don't hit any of those cars.
You got us into this parking lot, pal. Now you get us out. You want out of this parking lot? Okay.
Would there be anything else?
Yes, do you have a Miss Piggy?
It had, I think, 140 or 130 stores originally. And actually, we did them all over. We went in there and remodeled the whole works, put in breakaways, and decorated all those stores.
We had stores that were being dressed by people that had franchises that were there, and they came down and dressed them themselves. And there were two types of stores, ones we could wreck and ones we couldn't wreck.
It's Pants and Burgers. Yeah, lots of space in this mall.
We had hired, I won't say their names, but the most famous private security police force in the country. And we had hired them to guard, because we had millions of dollars of merchandise in there. And we made a deal with a lot of suppliers. Anything we didn't break, we didn't have to pay for, you know. So we had guards there, and things were being stolen. And finally called the police, and it turned out the guards were doing the stealing.
We had to get guards to watch the guards.
And background action, enjoying yourself.
And in the mall, all those stunt guys weren't drivers. All those stunt guys were, everyone on foot in the mall are stunt people. So that's where the huge numbers came in. You know.
I do remember that Danny Aykroyd thought that shooting at that mall was just one of the greatest things he'd ever seen. That he'd thought this up, and here it was. This bizarre car chase combining, you know, consumer goods and police cars, and his own mall. And I'll never forget just the sheer delight that this, you know, idea he'd had late one night was now being played out in a very big way.
Part of the joke of the first Blues Brothers is size. I mean, everything's gigantic. I mean, everything's exaggerated to such a huge extent. So it was interesting. People were going, well, car crash, song. Gee, that doesn't compute.
I just couldn't describe events without getting in trouble and without people looking at me like, what have you got us into?
Yeah, well, we did run over, but the footage is going to be excellent. I tell you, it's movie history. I know. No, I think in this sequence, we're going to be 2 days over. It'll all be on the screen, I promise. Okay, I'll see you in LA.
Obviously, one couldn't duplicate the first movie. It would cost too much. I mean, it cost $27 million then, which is much more than what we got now, actually. But that was a huge amount then. That was probably like 60 now. And we did this epic. I mean, we had 34 cars going 110 miles an hour in downtown Chicago. I don't think you could do that again.
Signal 1079er still engaged. Vehicle traveling southbound, approaching Chicago city limits. Commander advises will contact Chicago precincts for local intercept. Maintain pursuit. Use of unnecessary violence in the apprehension of the Blues Brothers has been approved.
Just the fact of what it took to film that in Chicago, tying off, you know, blocks and blocks of city streets, and, you know, multiple days of filming for really seconds of film.
We would shut down the city on weekends, I guess on Sundays, and we know when there wasn't a lot of traffic or people out, and, you know, so hopefully no one would cross in front of us. And they had like a, I don't know how many hundreds of PAs at every intersection, every alley, every doorway, so that no one would walk out and get hit.
Well, this is definitely Lower Wacker Drive. If my estimations are correct, we should be very close to the Honorable Richard J. Daley Plaza.
That's where they got that Picasso.
Yep.
We had great drivers. The doubles for Belushi and Aykroyd were Tommy Huff and Eddie Dono. And Tom Huff was a brilliant driver. And what we were doing in that movie that was unusual is they were going that fast. I mean, we were going 100 miles an hour. And so there's one shot in the movie when I shot it. I looked at it in dailies. I said, you know, people are going to think I sped this up. So we reshot it with pedestrians on the sidewalk. It was probably a wasted effort, but there's a shot in the movie where you see the Bluesmobile coming towards us and around a corner and under the L train, followed by these 20-some police cars. They're going 100 miles an hour. So we put people on the sidewalk so you could see they were going 100 miles an hour. And what was complicated about that was, in a city street, you have to make sure that all traffic is stopped. So we were shooting very early Saturday and Sunday mornings on a lot of this stuff. And make sure all traffic was stopped meant you had to have a PA with a walkie-talkie at every alley and street, and lots of cops, you know, for half a mile or a mile. You know, so these were big undertakings, this stuff. You know, we did big stuff.
Lots of effects, mechanical effects and visual effects that make that happen. And really one of the classic chases of all time. The Blues Brothers was really the first big picture allowed to shoot in Chicago since Daly had passed away. You may have heard that Daly had, Mrs. Mayor Daly, had come up with an edict that there would be no filming in Chicago. He wasn't going to allow it.
Partly because of an old M Squad episode where with Lee Marvin where it showed a Chicago cop accepting a bribe. You know, and Mayor Daly's, that's it.
One of the big issues, of course, given what we were planning, was how would we get permission to get the city of Chicago to let us film all of this?
We met with Mayor Jane Byrne. We had met with her to say how happy we were to be shooting in Chicago and so forth. And she asked, was there anything that she could do for us?
It was so Chicago, Mayor Byrne was very instrumental. And then other people, high placed, these kind of people helped us too, because, for instance, shooting in Daly Plaza, Cook County Board said, no. So we went above them, to the people who owned the Cook County Board. This is no longer true in Chicago. But it was amazing, the cooperation we got from the city and from the police.
Good news. The mayor of Chicago is going to allow us to take over Daly Plaza and drive the Bluesmobile through the lobby of the state office building. Good news, we got the permission. Bad news, we got the permission.
Back out, action! Action!
Well, I think it got what they wanted. It worked pretty slick, yeah.
Oh, it worked terrific. They stopped good. Brakes worked real good. How'd it look?
Looked terrific.
Oh. I couldn't see it. I had my eyes closed. Well,
the first thing I thought about was the Sam Fuller movies. I thought I was going to be making this great war movie. That's what went into my mind. I saw it as a battle sequence. And it really excited me, because we had the tanks, we had the army, we had so much stuff going on.
We'd have conversations. How many ISPs, Illinois State Police cars? Well, we got like 60 ISPs and 42 Chicago City cop cars and the 17 ambulances.
150 National Guardsmen, 60 Chicago cops.
350 guns, there's 150 batons.
4 Sherman tanks, 3 helicopters.
700 pounds of prime rib.
And 400 troops, okay, 400 troops. Well, if we've got the 400 troops, then what about the SWAT team?
John Landis directed this movie as General Westmoreland might prepare a battle.
Come on, men! Winning! Hustle, 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 hustle!
Go, 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 go!
Get those weapons ready, mister!
We had a place called the War Room, and in the War Room were maps of Chicago and aerial views, and this is where all the planning was done. If you're going to tie off major sections of Lower Wacker Drive or Lakeshore Drive, these things had to be carefully coordinated, and together with the assistant directors and the Chicago Police and Fire Departments, we staged some very, very big gags. From a logistics standpoint, I think the hardest number was the Cab Calloway number, which was a giant live large concert that we actually shot here in Hollywood at the Palladium. And there were thousands of extras, in fact, so many that we had promoted the audience through a local radio station. And in between the setups, we're entertaining them with local disc jockeys and giving away prizes and so forth. And there were wardrobe changes and lighting effects and so on. I think that was logistically, as far as anything inside was concerned, was the most difficult.
You guys know Minnie the Moocher?
I knew a hooker once named Minnie Mazzola.
No, the song Minnie the Moocher.
Yeah, so what?
Hit it!
I had a rough start with Cab. He came to Chicago to pre-record Minnie, and he was quite taken aback by the tracks. He listened to them, and he said, that's the way it sounded 50 years ago, because we were recording 50 years to the day he had written it. And I said, yeah, that's what I want. And he wanted to do a disco. He had just cut a disco version of Minnie the Moocher. And he told me he'd done Minnie Cha-Cha, done Minnie Twist, done Minnie Polka, done Minnie Rumba, you know, done all the major dance crazes. And he didn't understand why we wanted to do it this old fogey, old-fashioned way. And I told him, because that's great, and that's what I want. He was very unhappy about it, in very bad mood. And he's sort of this old guy, and he went into the recording studio and went in and did a take. And afterwards, said, how was that? And I said, I was unhappy with that, Cab. And his eyes got narrow. He said, what was wrong with it? So I said, well, it was mediocre, and you're Cab Calloway, so it should be great. And he said, oh, great? Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't tell me you wanted it great. He was really angry, so it was like real quiet. So he goes back in, he puts on the headphones, and we do another take, and it was great. And it's the one that's in the movie. It was great. But he finishes, and he takes off his headset, and he says, how is that? I said, that was great. He said, well, you got to tell me what you want. He just stormed out. And I thought, oh, shit. You know. But then when he showed up on location, he was lovely. And he had a really good time on the movie. And so there were no problems. But I tell you, it was a rocky start. I thought, uh-oh.
Sean Landis is something else. He is the greatest.
He loved sharing his experiences. And I don't know of anybody other than Duke Ellington who would have more stories. But the fact that he warmed up to us and wanted to, there was no aloofness, no distance, it made us feel very warm towards him. He was a sweet man, what a performer, man.
We used to sit down and talk. He used to talk about the times that, you know, like early days when he was shooting in Hollywood, the things that happened to him, you know. And he was a very friendly dude.
I told Cab that one thing that got me was that he just went absolutely straight ahead, you know. And he says, well, Lou, I learned something a long time ago. He says, when you got good musicians, you don't have to say anything. And if you don't have good musicians, there's nothing you can say.
Got any fried chicken?
Best damn chicken in the state.
Bring me 4 fried chickens and a Coke.
You want chicken wings or chicken legs?
4 fried chickens and a Coke.
It's a good movie. It's about Chicago. It's about music. It's
about 2 hours.
There's no sex and no drugs in the movie.
I had actually a funny story happen with John that I've told before, but it wasn't funny at the time. But we were having quite a big fight. We were over here at Universal shooting the interior of the church on stage 29. And it involved drugs. And I was extremely angry about this cocaine, and I'd thrown away a bunch of cocaine, and John was furious, and we had a big fight. We went out on Lancashire. So there's Jake Blue. He's in drag. And I'm out there, and we're yelling. I mean, we're really mad, and we're having an argument. And he finally said, well, fuck this and fuck you and you're like that. And he sort of sticks his thumb out. I mean, I don't even... But this car coming the opposite way goes, ah! It's a huge U-turn. It's convertible. And there's this kid, real stoner, goes, hey, John Belushi, man! And John jumps in the front and says, take me to the Chateau Marmont. You know, ah! Off, gone. You know, like that. At the time, it was not amusing. But in retrospect, it's pretty funny.
Over there is Alan Rubin. Over that side. That way.
Hi, how are you?
We all know that John has a bad boy, but a giving, wonderful soul. You go to his house and open his refrigerator like he would do it in your house, you know. You felt like you were at your friend's, and he would kill for his friends.
John was the type of person that if he decided you were his friend, then he more or less looked after you from then on. And he was quite a faithful friend to me.
The cops are always partying, and so I was... and still am, sort of like a loner, you know. But whenever he saw me sitting over in the corner anywhere, he'd always come over and says, Matt. He says, what's the matter? He says, are you okay?
He was a serious individual, but he was always clowning around, you know, and that was kind of about the basic of it, you know. And he was just a great guy, and we hung out. He'd come by the house, you know, and sit there and clean out my refrigerator. When he'd run out of food, he'd go somewhere else, you know. But no, he was just a super guy, a very, very giving guy, and it was a lot of fun. And
he's also a person who might show up at your house at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I loved him very much and still miss him.
John was kind of, like I say, you wanted him as your next-door neighbor. You want to hug him.
John was a wonderful person. I mean, I adored him. In fact, everybody adored John Belushi.
This is Mr. John Belushi and Mr. Dan
Polaroid.
Mr. Dan Polaroid. I've been calling him everything. Yeah. Like. Now, just a minute. I'll get you in a few minutes. You stay back till I call you. Now, I've compared these people, and I may have to swallow all of this. You understand? I may, because I'm figuring on them to take the places. We'll just say this, Abbott and Costello, Hope and Crosby, and Martin and Lewis, and Sinatra and his little group and everything like that, but they couldn't care these guys jockstrap. You know what I mean?
One night, nobody could find John. We didn't know where he was. We needed him for a shot. And someone said, well, I saw him walking over across the street. He crossed the street and went into that neighborhood over there. So we began to look for him, and we went to a house in the neighborhood, sort of basically, you know, looking for telltale signs of him. And someone said, oh, yeah, he went into that house there. We knocked on the door, and the guy came to the door, and he said, yes, Mr. Belushi's in. He's in on the couch. He's asleep. Perfect stranger. Turned out John had walked off the set, gone to somebody's house, knocked on the door, said, you know who I am, John Belushi. I'm tired. I'm hungry. He walked into the guy's fridge, opened the fridge, stood there at the fridge, the guy said, basically made himself a sandwich, had a glass of milk, you know, and then said, can I crash out on your couch? Perfect stranger crashed out on the couch. So John really was America's guest, and that really crystallized it, you know. That was really a funny night.
Party in the county jail. Prison that was hell that began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. Should have heard this knocked out jail, but sing, let's rock.
The Blues Brothers is a movie that, for whatever reasons, wherever I go all over the world, people love that movie, and it, these things take on a life of their own.
I would have never imagined that 17 years later I would still be playing with the same guys.
Dan Aykroyd is... helped blues probably more than anybody, and John Belushi if he hadn't died. I think from that first movie, there was some criticism given to John and Danny, but they've done more for blues than anybody in the last 20 years.
Dan Aykroyd's passion for rhythm and blues and basically black American music, one of the things the movie did quite successfully was draw attention back to these great artists. And you talk to James Brown or Aretha Franklin or any of these people, and they'll tell you their careers were revitalized, you know, and I'm proud of that. You know, I really am proud of that.
It broadened my audience, and it certainly introduced people to me who were not aware of who I was.
As soon as I got with the Blues Brothers band, and we did the Blues Brothers movie, one, I couldn't believe how I was accelerated, man.
I just knew we were making a great movie. In my heart, I knew. And even though maybe the reviews weren't great and people said it wasn't going to do well, I knew it was going to last forever.
I know the fans are there. There's, without question, the fans are there. And they go crazy when we go open a house of blues and there's 2,000 people and they're all going nuts. I mean, they love this band.
My wife and I were at Epcot Center, and it was about 11 o'clock at night. It was getting kind of dark. And this guy goes, man... Murphy Dunn, man. It's Murphy. Is that you? And I said, yeah. What are you going to do? He said, oh, no, I'm not going to. Can I touch you? I said, yeah. It's okay. Hi, how are you? Yeah, it just knocks me out when it happens.
It's funny, though. This one appearance, when I hold up that prophylactic, I'm telling you, it's weird. People still talk to me about it to this day. And they say it cracked them up.
Every now and again, even on the street or somewhere, it's like, hey, it's the Penguin. Which is great fun.
The movie is very much like Dragnet, you know, Jack Webb, very straightforward, thank you, ma'am, yep,
certainly something. I did something right because people love these characters, and they're wonderful things in the movie.
I'm one of his biggest fans. I think he's one of the great filmmakers of our age. He certainly made some of the best pictures of our time.
He's a great director. He's like a directing animal. It's like an animal. If there's an animal called a director, it would be John Landis.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.